But I was very heartened to hear this week that there's a non-frum person taking a frum person to a Din Torah. And I've been asked to act as the surveyor involved because it's a boundary dispute. So I thought, wow, what a Kiddush Hashem, I said to the registrar. And he said, no, it's not that. It's not really a Kiddush Hashem. It's just that he thinks he's getting a cheaper deal by going to it. Yeah, wait till he finds out. And what he also doesn't realise is the criteria used by the Bedin are much more harsh for him than a civil court. Whereas in a civil court they might go by documents, records which don't exist, or measuring things on site. But in Jewish court of law, the principle is Hamotzi Michavon of Arayah. So the one who's taking him to court has to prove that the boundary fence is in the wrong place, and it's much harder than anywhere else. Anyway. Yeah, he wants to go to the Din Torah. He'll go to the Din Torah, and he will get justice according to the Torah way.
Why did you say that?
Well, I think one has to go through the experience of a non-Jewish court to know how ridiculously it's a game of roulette. You're subject to a jury system, and the people are on that jury can be any Tom, Dick or Harry, and it's their decision, not the judge's. That was the case of the case of court where the judge asked the jury to decide, and everybody's Yiddish, as you know. They adjourn because of the Yomim Tovim, because the barristers are all Jewish, and then it comes to the jury to decide, and the head of the jury comes up, Mr. Cohen, and he says to the judge, Your Honour, we've discussed it, and we want to tell you, we just can't make up our minds. We don't want to mix in. The whole concept of the jury system has a flaw in it, because what are you getting justice from? From people who might not even understand the facts that are going on.
So why is that Kiddush
Hashem? A Kiddush Hashem is in a number of ways. First of all, that the Torah applies to all generations, and that principles of the Torah can apply to any particular circumstances. And obviously you'll get someone coming out of any court case feeling upset and not getting what they wanted. But the fact that the Torah is the flagship of the Jewish people and can be applied to all circumstances, and that the case is determined on by people who are experienced, who have had the experience of sitting with other Dayanim and have gone through a process, that in itself is a Kiddush Hashem. And very often someone will come out from a non-Jewish court law feeling as though they haven't got the right decision because the jury were more interested in the football results than in what was going on the day. The law books in English law actually admit I had a case once in my own experience when I was a local government officer that the local authority, under political pressure, allowed a very large unacceptable form of development which was harmful to the neighbour, and the officers of the local authority just had their hands tied, myself and my own colleagues. The case, though, afterwards went to a Din Torah because all the parties were Jewish. The case went to a Din Torah, and the Beis Din managed to formulate a solution which the local authority were unable to do to make sure that the development would not be harmful. And there was an admiration from my non-Jewish colleagues about the fact that this problem could be solved by a Beis Din and could not be solved by the local authority. It was a Kiddush Hashem. Now, our subject today, science and evidence, is to ask ourselves, in what circumstances can science be used in evidence? That is to say, we've got in modern technology not just telephones and faxes and what have you, we've got genetic aspects, DNA, which we've discussed already once in the past, we've got fingerprints, we've got lie detectors. To what extent can these be used and a Beis Din can rely upon them in determining evidence? So we're going to look at a few principles. We're not going to give Psak Din, but draw from a few things which are very interesting from the sources. So anyway, it's an amplification and extension of the subject of DNA which we once discussed. Now when it comes to capital cases, if there's murder or something like that, the Torah is very clear. It says, Alpi Shnai Meidim Yokum Dovah, you need to have two witnesses, two kosher witnesses. And the criteria used for having kosher witnesses, when I say kosher, it doesn't mean you can eat them. They have to fulfill criteria to a very high standard. And that these two witnesses have actually warned beforehand about this sin taking place, and they have to actually see the crime taking place before a conviction can be exercised. So the question in Jewish law is, it's very rare to have two witnesses actually seeing something properly. What about circumstantial evidence? Because if you ask yourself whether you can use DNA or if you can use a lie detector or anything like that, that is not two witnesses actually seeing something. It's not two human beings who are able to see what's going on. It's what you would call circumstantial evidence. And there are different kinds of circumstantial evidence. There is an interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Beis, about Rav Shimon ben Shetach, who actually sees somebody holding a knife which is dripping blood. And he has seen somebody having been stabbed, but he didn't actually see the stabbing itself. Can we convict that person? And this one witness alone is not enough, because you need two witnesses. So however sure you are that that person has actually committed a murder, you haven't seen the murder, and you haven't had two witnesses seeing the murder, the Torah does not allow capital punishment to take place. Obviously, the Beis Din has its powers to use other forms of punishment if they are certain that somebody was a murderer. Then they can't exercise capital punishment without those two proper witnesses. And the Beis Din, with the rules of Horel Shah, can lock up somebody and do all sorts of things. But they cannot exercise capital punishment in those circumstances. So the question isn't only on capital punishment or where there's a crime relating to murder. It can relate to monetary matters where you need evidence. It can relate to Yerusha. It can relate to the problems of Aguna, of whether we can allow a woman to remarry. So Rambam says in Hilchos Gerushin, he says you don't necessarily need witnesses for everything. He says there in Perek Yud Gimel Halacha Kaftes that witnesses are only really required when you need to clarify, when you do have a doubt. But when there's no doubt at all and you know for certain the roots of the case, then you might not need witnesses. Thus, when it comes to matters, say, of kashrus, and you know for sure that something is reliable, you don't need two witnesses. Let's have a practical example. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in Yigris Moshe, he writes in Yeradel in the first volume, Perek Mem Zayin, he talks about milk which comes from a non-Jewish factory, but you are so certain that that milk would not have anything non-kosher mixed with it because of the rules and regulations which the government has endorsed and applied. So there he uses that as a heter for drinking milk which is not shomed properly, but was done by a large factory. I'm not coming along and saying you can drink non-shomed milk, because he ends up saying we should still try to keep up the tradition. But this is a well-known psak where he is relying on a principle of circumstantial evidence. It's not evidence at all, because you don't have witnesses actually seeing the milk, and there is a matter of kashrus. So on what basis would he allow such a thing? There is a certain assumption built in to the psak, and it's where there is an assumption that you might be allowed to say, we will give this the benefit of the doubt and say it's okay. Michalkas Yaakov writes in his second volume, Lamed Aleph, he uses the phrase yediyot velo brura, where you know something but you don't have it 100% with certainty. And he applies this to the rules of Aguna, of whether we can allow a woman to remarry when her husband has disappeared. Now there's an amazing psak from Dain Weiss of the Minchas Yitzchok, where he says nowadays with modern technology we have telephones, and he says if a husband goes missing we can be almost certain that if he goes away anywhere, or he's abroad when he's held up, he will phone up home and he will say, listen, don't worry about me, I'm over here somewhere or whatever. That's in the assumption that he hasn't had a horrible argument or row with his wife and he just wants to spite her and disappear and make it look as though he's disappeared. But on the basis that no such event has happened and that their relationship was cordial and amicable, if somebody disappears, there is an assumption to start off with that if he would be alive, he would phone up home. And if, say, 30 days go by and he hasn't phoned home, we might come to the very unfortunate assumption that he's not alive anymore. But that's not necessarily so, and each case might depend on its own merits. There were unfortunate incidents with the concentration camps during the war, that husbands went missing. And it was very common for a Beis Din to decide on the principle of Mayim She'eshlahem Sof. What's Mayim She'eshlahem Sof? There's a principle in the Gemara that if you see somebody falling into the water where there's a lake and you can see all the edges, and you see somebody falling in and you don't see them coming out again, then we assume that that person has drowned. You didn't actually see the person dying. You didn't see him drowning. You only saw him going into the water, but you didn't see him come up. So that's a very strong assumption that that person has drowned. And they used that principle that if somebody was seen going into a concentration camp, Rachmana Litzlan, then it was decided we apply the principle of Mayim She'eshlahem Sof and the woman can remarry. It wasn't always the case. Fortunately, sometimes a husband did come back and there were problems for a Beis Din to sort out. What do we do now if she had remarried? But that's a topic for another time. Sorry? Yeah. But the Gemara in Yevamos in Memhei, and there's a Tosus there, talks about when a woman becomes a get, said a gioris, not yet, and she converts and she dips in the mikveh. Now the Ionim are supposed to watch somebody dipping in the mikveh, but they can't watch a woman dipping in the mikveh, so they stand outside. And she goes in the mikveh and they hear her dipping and they hear the water, bloom, bloom, and she dips, and they know that she's dipped, and they say that she's now Jewish, but they don't actually see her going into the water, mishum tzinius. So there is something where something isn't actually seen, but we know, there's Eo, we know that it has happened, and therefore she's Jewish. There's no reason to suspect otherwise.
What happens when denigrates a woman to the water?
We do, we may well have a woman standing there, but the woman is not two male witnesses. Right? And you can't have two male witnesses watching the woman going to the mikveh. But we do accept the word of a woman if a woman says she has gone down. And how do we know that an Eidechor is Ne'eman B'Yisurim, one witness instead of two? From the subject of women, because of the subject of Nida. If a woman says to her husband, I have been to the mikveh, then we trust her. We don't need witnesses. She has said so. So we say, one Eidechor is Ne'eman B'Yisurim. So it's the same way. If a woman says to you, this food is kosher, then you can accept that this food is kosher, even though you don't have the two witnesses normally required by the Torah, Pishnayim Edim Yochum Dovor. So there's a Gemara in Kedushin Samach Vav Amud Aleph where just one person reported to a man about his wife being adulterous. We believe that person. If one person saw a woman doing something which appeared adulterous, then we take that evidence seriously. There's a Gemara in Kedushin. So what does it boil down to? There's a principle called Umdana. Umdana means assumption. We can, in halacha, make certain assumptions in the absence of the two witnesses. And this all is to hark back to our subject of scientific evidence, because if that scientific evidence is very strong and very reasonable, then a Beis Din can use it in many circumstances. For example, there's another Gemara, in Baba Basra, the Munches Amud Aleph. There the Gemara talks about a woman who had 10 children. Sounds very nice, but the unfortunate thing is that only one of those children was from her husband. The other 9 children were born from adulterous relationships. So the man said, well, before he died, the husband said he knew that he only had one son, and he had a will that only his true son should get his Yerusha. So the problem was brought before Rav Bunah, what do we do? How do we determine, you know, who gets it? There are 10 children here. Well, this is not very scientific.
Sorry, he didn't actually know which one was his, was he?
Rav Bunah didn't know which one was his. We might assume from the story I'm telling you that the true child knew, but That's not really told to us. What Rav Buna did was, it was a rather unscientific exercise, but it was based on Umdana. He told each of the children to separately, individually, without seeing the others, to spit on their father's grave. And there was one child who refused to do so. This child said, I would rather forego my inheritance than spit on my father's grave. And Rav Buna said, that is the real son. That's the Gemara. Alright, you might say it's not a scientific method, but it's an assumption method. And he was entitled to use an assumption in order to determine the case in the absence of any other evidence. The Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, actually asks... Yeah, it's a psychological test. Yeah.
The question was, didn't the father know which son it was? If he did, though, right?
Yeah.
No, before he died.
Then why would he say so?
He wrote the will.
To my son. He wrote to my son.
But why didn't he say to my son?
But he didn't say who the son was. So that was the problem. So yes, it was a psychological test.
How did the
child? Yeah, Shlomo HaMelech. He said, I'll cut this baby in half. It's the same idea. He used a psychological test, and that was enough to determine, and he was right.
In that case, the woman knew it was her baby, but the son didn't necessarily know it was the son.
I don't know, I think it's mashma from the Gemara that the son knew that he was the son of that man.
The other sons wanted the Yerusha, so they wouldn't tell
him. Yeah, they were all going to pretend that they were the son. We're not told. We might assume anything that his father told him, or that he had the same characteristics, or something like that.
The other
got
Chinese.
I don't know.
You can rely on
Maybe he was black skinned and all the others were white.
That could be Kogak.
Right, the idea is that we find from the Gemara and Bava Basra a method of a psychological test being used to determine who was the right child. So when we're talking about assumptions, this principle is brought by Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he talks about, can you go into an old shul, which is more or less abandoned, and there are svarim lying there, can you take svarim away? No, I can make use of this, nobody here is using them, can I take such svarim? He paskens that you can't, it's still a form of labor. You can't assume, oh, nobody's using it, therefore I can just go and take it. You still have to have permission. Although the Chelkas Yaakov, in his first volume, chapter 136, say that if it's a shul which was in Nazi Germany, which has definitely been abandoned, you may take the svarim away from there for safekeeping. Now, that is talking about assumptions. There is something else in Halacha which is called not Umdana, but Umdana Demuchach. Umdana Demuchach means it's compelling evidence, which is what you might say in English terminology, beyond all reasonable doubt. Because there are two criteria used in the English courts of law. One is the balance of probability, where it seems most likely that such and such happened. And there you might use the term umdana. But then in the criminal courts, they apply where they will only convict the criminal where it's beyond all reasonable doubt, which is compelling evidence. Now, beyond all reasonable doubt is not good enough in halacha when you're going to convict a murderer. You need more than beyond all reasonable doubt. You need those two witnesses who say, we were at the site and we saw it happen and this is how it happened and we warned him, etc. Beyond all reasonable doubt, though, is something a bit less. Now, if, for example, the missing husband we spoke about. If the missing husband has not phoned, the Minchas Yitzchok actually calls this umdana demucha. He already says this is something which is, you know, it's unheard of. You can argue against something that has to be, you say, what if the guy was kidnapped? So he couldn't get to a telephone. And if he was kidnapped, then, well, they're holding him for who knows how long length of time, and he's unable to contact his family. And if there is a possibility of that happening, then you have to realize that it's not umdana demuchach, and then she is still an umdana. But if there is no likelihood that he was kidnapped, and he just disappears and he doesn't phone up, then there is a very strong presumption that he has died because he hasn't phoned up to say where he is.
So when was that
missing? Well, Lukas Yitzchok wrote this about 40 or so years ago. He was Lifter only relatively recently. Dain Weiss, who's one of the leading poskim of our generation. He wrote this Minchas Yitzchak.
Sometimes somebody goes missing, but you can't just assume that you have to.
Yeah, you need something, but what he wrote was a chiddush. The general presumption of poskim is when it comes to aguna, we need something, but we're prepared to go on the lenient side. That there is, we're allowed to go a bit on the lenient side in order to enable her to remarry. The misery which the aguna goes through is something which is taken very much into account. We need something, we need some evidence, but. There are cases where the poskim will go more leniently for the aguna.
Somebody, let's say, goes on the boat and the ship sinks. You don't make sure that the person.
Well, there are poskim about this. What if? What if there's a plane crash or boat sinks and they find body parts? If they don't find anything, all right. Let's say you know somebody was on a plane and the plane crashed, and everybody on that plane died, and you know that that person went on the plane. There are tshuvas on this that we accept that the person has died and his wife may remarry. There is that kind of psak given.
That is very similar to the case of a person dumping into a lake and looking for
an yeah, Maim Sheifen Haim Sof. There is also psak about body parts. Can you use the DNA on those body parts to determine? If you find a ring on a finger, that is not considered good enough. If the fellow had initials and they were engraved on a ring and they find those on a finger which is found, then there is the possibility that somebody's stolen that ring and is wearing it themselves. It's not necessarily that person. But if DNA, or if a person had six fingers instead of five, or four fingers instead of five, there is a psak given that we use that as sufficient evidence to say that that has died, because that was a simon of that particular person, and it's not common to find that simon on anyone else.
I had a great chance. When the door was down, it was sunk, and she had terrible problems getting in there because she had to find witnesses who survived to prove to the base din that where he had been in the boat, no one had survived.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem. If there are survivors, then there is the problem maybe that person survived as well. If there are no survivors at all, like the plane goes into the sea, then unfortunate that it is, it's easier for psak to be given to release the aguna.
So they know the man bought the thing.
Well, that they'll be able to verify, yes, wouldn't they?
Definitely. It might turn up.
Yeah. There has to be something to show that he did board the plane. If they issued a boarding pass, that might be. I'm not giving suck here. Now CCTV is another question. There is a question asked in the halacha about if a marriage takes place and there were no kosher witnesses. There was a case with the Chasam Sofer where there were two kosher witnesses, but afterwards the Chasam revealed that although he was a witness, he was related to the Chasam or Kana, and therefore he was disqualified. And the question came before the Chasam Sofer, are these two people legally married? And the Chasam Sofer gave a psak to say that there were lots of other people present. They didn't actually see the ring going on the finger, but there were lots of Jewish people present. They could see the ring beforehand, they could see the ring afterwards, and therefore he said we can accept that they were legally married. I was in fact at a wedding not very long ago, not in this country, where after the wedding something came up that it turned out that one of the witnesses was not Shomer Shabbos. And so it was a question about what did the Chasam and Kala do. And there is the psak of the Chasam Sofer that there were other people present who could see what was going on, other people who would be kosher witnesses, even though they were not designated as witnesses. On the basis of that Chasam Sofer, they had no problem.
That's just the other way around, because many people who are either accused to give or collect the get go back to the witnesses, and one of the witnesses is not showing the child, they bet him when they say find the marriage is annulled at that point.
Yeah, Rabbi Feinstein actually talks about a reform marriage where there are no kosher witnesses, so they were never married in the first place.
Or a civil marriage where there are kosher witnesses.
Yeah. Then that they were married, yeah. So yeah, these questions all come up. We're not here trying to give suck for all these different occasions. What we're looking at are the principles, interesting as they are, to see how the halacha is possible to apply in all these circumstances, and how it can apply to modern scientific methods. you can certainly use DNA. There's a the Beis HaMedrash of Rav Rosen and Meibarak did a kuntres on the subject of just DNA. DNA is equivalent of umdeno zemuchach. It's more than umdeno, which is an assumption. It's compelling evidence because it's 1 in 50 million that when you get some sort of, it's like a fingerprint. It's more than a fingerprint to show that something can be attributed to a particular person. Then that is compelling evidence for a Beis Din.
It's not total evidence.
It's not total evidence.
It doesn't prove that the act was either took place or the act was placed by that individual. It shows that they were there, like the fingerprint showed that they were there.
Rav Rosner's Beis HaMedrash issued this psak that in cases of Aguna, one shouldn't just rely on DNA, but there should be something else which supports that evidence as well. So like two items of evidence. Yeah. So there is a case where, what about a video? What about if you had a wedding and the witnesses were not kosher, but you've got a video of the ring going on the finger? Can we rely on... Can we rely on the fact that there's a video camera which filmed what was going on? It's enough to prove that they are legally married. The general psak is that a video on its own is not enough evidence. There can be trick photography going on, I suppose. It's not enough. But if there were other people there at the chasna, yes, that should help. In the case that I was actually at, the rav who was asked said it's preferable that the couple do go through some form of kiddushin and yichud again, if at all possible. And it can be done privately and discreetly without other people in the relations not having to get upset over it. Well, that's a story of its own. The couple didn't really want to because they felt as though it meant the first time round that they were living in sin. Anyway, if two people are seen entering a building and one emerges wounded, then the Shulchan Aruch says that we know that the other person was guilty of wounding that person. That's Shulchan Aruch and Kosher Mishpat. Only two people, and you know for sure that that building was empty, and one person came out severely wounded, you know that it was the other person who caused it. Alright, if it was a wound which couldn't have been inflicted by a person upon himself, right? If a person could have done it on himself, then that would negate any assumption that the other person did it. It has to be one where it's impossible for that person to have done such a wound upon himself. Now, polygraphs, as they're called, lie detectors, are very sophisticated pieces of equipment which measure your pulse rate, your respiration rate, your blood pressure, any unusual body movements which might take place when you might be telling a lie. Well, can you beat it? If you are subject to test, can you be aware of the way that it works and be such a good actor that when you tell your lie, you will be able to beat that lie detector?
Or conversely, one may be in a nervous disposition and you can tell guilty or not.
Anyway, there is a website called, I think it's called liesandtruth.com, which says that it is possible for a person to actually beat the system of a lie detector if he knows how it works and how to organise himself and the way he gives his answers. It is possible to tell a lie and the lie detector will not pick it up. So that in itself might show that there is no umdeno demuchach with a lie detector, like there might be with DNA. The Gemara in Kiddushin actually talks about when a marriage takes place by consummation. There are three ways in which a marriage can take place, b'kesef, b'shtav, b'biyah. And nowadays it's not allowed for Kiddushin to take place with Bior, with intercourse. It's only the consummation afterwards, after the Nisuin. But for the Kiddushin, it's not allowed. But if, in Talmudic times, it took place, then what about the witnesses? The witnesses cannot be a party to actually watching the consummation taking place. The Gemara talks about them standing outside. So they don't actually see it taking place. But there again, they have a very good idea about the fact that it's taking place, that they see them going in with Yichud into a room. There again, you've got an umdeno demuchach. You don't have clear evidence. So that harks back to whether you saw the actual ring being put on the finger. There is a machlokus whether you actually have to see the ring going on the finger. Now, the Ramah is particular to see it going on the finger, but the Mordechai says it's okay if beforehand you saw the ring going on, not actually going on, and afterwards you saw the ring gone. you have an area where there's only a small number of Jewish people, and there's a pressure to give a kosher certificate to somebody who is not a Shomer Shabbos. You know he's not a Shomer Shabbos. Can you give such a person a kosher hechsher if he gives his guarantee that he's going to be very reliable, that he will keep to the standards of kashrus? But Moshe Feinstein actually writes in Yerodeah Nundalit that you can give him a hechsher for his food, provided that in all other matters you know that he's a trustworthy person and that you are constantly monitoring him. Otherwise, you can't. So we have to rely sometimes upon what is on people's minds. And we have to sometimes rely on assumptions on what goes on in people's minds. For example, if somebody pledges a large amount of money to build a shul in a particular community, and he gives down a certain down payment, and then the shul starts being built, and then he mixes with that shul and he realizes that the people there are not the sort of people he'd like to mix with. So he decides that the rest of the money which he gave a pledge for, he's going to give to another shul, and not to this shul. Can he then change giving the money from one to another? Can we say that there was an assumption in his mind that when he pledged the money, it was on the basis that he would like this community which he was going to mix with? So there's a psak given there that he can change, provided he does a hataras nadorim, because there was a kind of vow. Another shaila, which comes up in the Igris Moshe. A widow, she gave assets to her grandchildren. Why? Because she was marrying again and she didn't want her new husband to have her assets. That's a nice way to start an affair. She didn't want her new husband to have her assets, so she gave them away to her grandchildren on the basis that she doesn't want anybody else to have them. Then her second marriage turned out in a divorce. Can she then ask for her money back from her grandchildren on the basis that it was given on the assumption that she was single and she wanted the money for herself and she was only giving it away because she didn't want her husband to get it? So on that basis, he gives a psak. What are the two kinds of assumption? There are two kinds of assumption. One is umdu, where it's not obvious, but there is an assumption that some sort of statement needs to be given. It needs to be verbalized. It needs to be said explicitly, I am giving this money on the basis that. And then you've got the umdu no demuchach, where you don't have to have these stipulations, where the evidence is so compelling, you don't need it. What if elderly parents come and live with children who are not necessarily keeping kosher properly? Can they rely on the kashrus of their children with an assumption? Gemara Kesuvah, Snaf Pei Hei, talks about Rav, who was prepared to accept evidence just on his wife. Well, his wife said, you can't have such and such a witness because he's a thief. So she herself was one witness and she was a woman. He accepted what she said, it was reliable. There was no doubt existing in her mind that this fellow was a thief. Therefore we could trust her. So, summary, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Kaf, that you need Eidim. When it comes to capital punishment, I'll be Shnayim Eidim Yochum Dovo. There's no question about it. But then later on in Perek Kaf Dalet, he says, Afidu Bali Eidim, when it comes to Dinei Momonos, monetary matters, and civil law matters, you can rely on evidence without Eidim. And that is the generalized summary. When it comes to using DNA, fingerprints, lie detectors, other electronic equipment, it's not enough when it comes to crimes like capital punishment being executed. It's not good enough at all. You need those two witnesses. But when it comes to monetary matters, or aguna matters, then we are prepared to use umdana, but invariably it has to be umdana demuchach. Such compelling evidence that there is no way it could be false evidence. And it's beyond all reasonable doubt. Thank you very much for listening to me so patiently. Bye.